Chapter 78. Rosamond and Will stood motionless. They did not know how long. He looking towards the spot where Dorothea had stood, and she looking towards him with doubt, seemed an endless time to Rosamond, in whose inmost soul there was hardly so much annoyance as gratification from what had just happened. Shallow natures dream of an easy sway over the emotions of others, trusting implicitly in their own petty magic to turn the deepest streams, and confident, by pretty gestures and remarks, of making the thing that is not as though it were. She knew that Will had received a severe blow, but she had been little used to imagining other people's states of mind except as a material cut into shape by her own wishes, and she believed in her own power to soothe or subdue. Even Tertius, that most perverse of men, was always subdued in the long run. Events had been obstinate, but still Rosamond would have said now, as she did before her marriage, that she never gave up what she'd set her mind on. She put out her arm and laid the tips of her fingers on Will's coat sleeve. "Don't touch me," he said with an utterance like the cut of a lash, darting from her and changing from pink to white and back again, as if his whole frame were tingling with the pain of the sting. He wheeled round to the other side of the room and stood opposite to her, with the tips of his fingers in his pockets and his head thrown back, looking fiercely not at Rosamond but at a point a few inches away from her. She was keenly offended, but the signs she made of this were such as only Lydgate was used to interpret. She became suddenly quiet and seated herself, untying her hanging bonnet and laying it down with her shawl. Her little hands, which she had folded before her, were very cold. It would have been safer for Will in the first instance to have taken up his hat and gone away, but he had felt no impulse to do this. On the contrary, he had a horrible inclination to stay and shatter Rosamond with his anger. It seemed as impossible to bear the fatality she had drawn down on him without venting his fury, as it would be to a panther to bear the javelin wound without springing and biting. And yet, how could he tell a woman that he was ready to curse her? He was fuming under a repressive law which he was forced to acknowledge. He was dangerously poised, and Rosamond's voice now brought the decisive vibration. In flute-like tones of sarcasm, she said, "You can easily go after Mrs. Cosbon and explain your preference." "Go after her!" he burst out, with a sharp edge in his voice. "Do you think she would turn to look at me, or value any word I ever utter to her again at more than a dirty feather? Explain! How can a man explain at the expense of a woman?"
"You can tell her what you please," said Rosamond, with more tremor.
"Do you suppose she would like me better for sacrificing you? She's not a woman to be flattered because I made myself despicable, to believe that I must be true to her because I was a dastard to you." He began to move about with the restlessness of a wild animal that sees prey but cannot reach it. Presently he burst out again. "I had no hope before, not much, of anything better to come, but I had one certainty, that she believed in me. Whatever people had said or done about me, she believed in me. That's gone. She'll never again think me anything but a paltry pretense. Too nice to take heaven except upon flattering conditions, and yet selling myself for any devil's change by the sly. She'll think of me as an incarnate insult to her from the first moment we—" Will stopped, as if he'd found himself grasping something that must not be thrown and shattered. He found another vent for his rage by snatching up Rosamond's words again, as if they were reptiles to be throttled and flung off. "Explain! Tell a man to explain how he dropped into hell! Explain my preference! I never had a preference for her, any more than I have a preference for breathing. No other woman exists by the side of her. I would rather touch her hand if it were dead than I would touch any other woman's living." Rosamond, while these poised weapons were being hurled at her, was almost losing the sense of her identity, and seemed to be waking into some new, terrible existence. She had no sense of chill, resolute repulsion, of reticent self-justification such as she had known under Lydgate's most stormy displeasure. All of her sensibility was turned into a bewildering novelty of pain. She felt a new, terrified recoil under a lash never experienced before. What another nature felt in opposition to her own was being burnt and bitten into her consciousness,
When Will had ceased to speak, she'd become an image of sickened misery. Her lips were pale, and her eyes had a tearless dismay in them. If it had been Tertius who stood opposite to her, that look of misery would have been a pang to him, and he would have sunk by her side to comfort her, with that strong-armed comfort which she had often held very cheap. Let it be forgiven to Will that he had no such movement of pity. He'd felt no bond beforehand to this woman, who had spoiled the ideal treasure of his life, and he held himself blameless. He knew that he was cruel, but he had no relenting in him yet. After he had done speaking, he still moved about, half in absence of mind, and Rosamond sat perfectly still. At length, Will, seeming to bethink himself, took up his hat, yet stood some moments irresolute. He had spoken to her in a way that made a phrase of common politeness difficult to utter. And yet, now that he had come to the point of going away from her without further speech, he shrank from it as a brutality. He felt checked and stultified in his anger. He walked towards the mantelpiece and leaned his arm on it and waited in silence for he hardly knew what. The vindictive fire was still burning in him, and he could utter no word of retraction. But it was nevertheless in his mind that having come back to this hearth where he had enjoyed a caressing friendship, he had found calamity seated there. He had had suddenly revealed to him a trouble that lay outside the home as well as within it. And what seemed a foreboding was pressed upon him as with slow pincers, that his life might come to be enslaved by this helpless woman who had thrown herself upon him in the dreary sadness of her heart. But he was in gloomy rebellion against the fact that his quick apprehensiveness foreshadowed to him. And when his eyes fell on Rosamond's blighted face, it seemed to him that he was the more pitiable of the two. For pain must enter into its glorified life of memory before it can turn into compassion. And so they remained for many minutes, opposite each other, far apart, in silence. Will's face still possessed by a mute rage and Rosamond's by a mute misery. The poor thing had no force to fling out any passion in return. The terrible collapse of the illusion towards which all her hope had been strained was a stroke which had too thoroughly shaken her. Her little world was in ruins, and she felt herself tottering in the midst as a lonely, bewildered consciousness. Will wished that she would speak and bring some mitigating shadow across his own cruel speech, which seemed to stand staring at them both in mockery of any attempt at revived fellowship. But she said nothing, and at last, with a desperate effort over himself, he asked, "Shall I come in and see Lydgate this evening?"
"If you like," Rosamond answered, just audibly.
And then Will went out of the house, Martha never knowing that he had been in. After he was gone, Rosamond tried to get up from her seat, but fell back, fainting. When she came to herself again, she felt too ill to make the exertion of rising to ring the bell. And she remained helpless until the girl, surprised at her long absence, thought for the first time of looking for her in all the downstairs rooms. Rosamond said that she had felt suddenly sick and faint, and wanted to be helped upstairs. When there, she threw herself on the bed with her clothes on, and lay in apparent torpor, as she had done once before on a memorable day of grief. Lydgate came home earlier than he had expected, about 5:30, and found her there. The perception that she was ill threw every other thought into the background. When he felt her pulse, her eyes rested on him with more persistence than they had done for a long while, as if she felt some content that he was there. He perceived the difference in a moment, and seating himself by her, put his arm gently under her, and bending over her, he said, "My poor Rosamond! Has something agitated you?" Clinging to him, she fell into hysterical sobbings and cries, and for the next hour he did nothing but soothe and tend her. He imagined that Dorothea had been to see her, and that all this effect on her nervous system, which evidently involved some new turning towards himself, was due to the excitement of the new impressions which that visit had raised. Chapter 79. When Rosamond was quiet and Lydgate had left her, hoping that she might soon sleep under the effect of an anodyne, he went into the drawing-room to fetch a book which he had left there, meaning to spend the evening in his workroom, and he saw on the table Dorothea's letter addressed to him. He had not ventured to ask Rosamond if Mrs. Casaubon had called, but the reading of this letter assured him of the fact, for Dorothea mentioned that it was to be carried by herself. When Will Ladislaw came in a little later, Lydgate met him with a surprise which made it clear that he had not been told of the earlier visit, and Will could not say, "Did not Mrs. Lydgate tell you that I came this morning?" "Poor Rosamond is ill," Lydgate added immediately on his greeting. "Not seriously, I hope," said Will.
"No, only a slight nervous shock,
the effect of some agitation. She's been overwrought lately. The truth is, Ladislaw, I am an unlucky devil. We've gone through several rounds of purgatory since you left, and I've lately got on to a worse ledge of it than ever. I suppose you are only just come down. You look rather battered. You've not been long enough in the town to hear anything?"
"I travelled all night and got to the White Hart at 8 o'clock this morning. I've been shutting myself up and resting," said Will, feeling himself a sneak but seeing no alternative to this evasion.
And then he heard Lydgate's accounts of the troubles which Rosamond had already depicted to him in her way. She had not mentioned the fact of Will's name being connected with the public story, this detail not immediately affecting her, and he now heard it for the first time.
"I thought it better to tell you that your name is mixed up with the disclosure," said Lydgate, who could understand better than most men how Ladislaw might be stung by the revelation. "You will be sure to hear it as soon as you turn out into the town. I suppose it is true that Raffles spoke to you."
"Yes," said Will, sardonically. "She'll be fortunate if gossip does not make me the most disreputable person in the whole affair. I should think the latest version must be that I plotted with Raffles to murder Bulstrode and ran away from Middlemarch for the purpose." He was thinking, "Here is a new ring in the sound of my name to recommend it in her hearing. However, what does it signify now?" But he said nothing of Bulstrode's offer to him. Will was very open and careless about his personal affairs, but it was among the more exquisite touches in nature's modeling of him that he had a delicate generosity which warned him into reticence here. He shrank from saying that he had rejected Bulstrode's money in the moment when he was learning that it was Lydgate's misfortune to have accepted it. Lydgate, too, was reticent in the midst of his confidence. He made no allusion to Rosamond's feeling under their trouble, and of Dorothea he only said, "Mrs. Casaubon has been the one person to come forward and say that she had no belief in any of the suspicions against me." Observing a change in Will's face, he avoided any further mention of her, feeling himself too ignorant of their relation to each other not to fear that his words might have some hidden, painful bearing on it. And it occurred to him that Dorothea was the real cause of the present visit to Middlemarch. The two men were pitying each other, but it was only Will who guessed the extent of his companion's trouble. When Lydgate spoke with desperate resignation of going to settle in London, and said with a faint smile, "We shall have you again, old fellow," Will felt inexpressibly mournful and said nothing. Rosamond had that morning entreated him to urge this step on Lydgate, and it seemed to him as if he were beholding in a magical panorama a future where he himself was sliding into that pleasureless yielding to the small solicitations of circumstance, which is a commoner history of perdition than any single momentous bargain. We are on a perilous margin when we begin to look passively at our future selves and see our own figures led with dull consent into insipid misdoing and shabby achievement. Poor Lydgate was inwardly groaning on that margin, and Will was arriving at it. It seemed to him this evening as if the cruelty of his outburst to Rosamond had made an obligation for him, and he dreaded the obligation. He dreaded Lydgate's unsuspecting goodwill. He dreaded his own distaste for his spoiled life, which would leave him in motiveless levity.